Welcome. Good afternoon, everybody. It's rainy afternoon. Thanks for making the trek here in all sorts of nice weather. I see a bunch of questions from yesterday. How many folks here weren't at Julie's talk yesterday? Half and half. Well, thanks for showing up, and I hope that her talk today is as provocative and interesting as yesterday was. And we're going to be shifting gears now into the world of neoliberalism. I want to remind you that there's a public seminar tomorrow at 12:20 in room 8108. So that's in this building over yonder. But to get there, you can't get there from here. You got to go downstairs and then over and then up. And if you want more explicit directions, so you're not lost at the last minute, just let us know after the talk. I can explain it. And the public seminar tomorrow is really a roundtable discussion, and I think it could be a great opportunity for a lot of people here to talk about these research questions that Julie is proposing and studying and exploring, and we can talk about how we go about doing this kind of research and how we can intervene from the academy into these important social questions. So I think without further ado, I'll turn it over to Julie. Thanks.
Hi, thanks. Thanks again for those of you who are doing day two of this. That's pretty flattering. And for the rest of you, hi, thanks for coming. I know, as I said yesterday, you're no longer a battleground state here in Wisconsin. Although I do get to see commercials I don't get to see at home in California. So you're battleground enough that to pull yourself away from the electoral maps and the Dow Jones industrial is very flattering. So thank you for coming. And thanks again to those of you who brought me here. It is really a pleasure. Okay, so I'm going to just launch right in here and thinking about food and neoliberalism. So certainly in the last year, food politics has taken center stage around the world. We've heard a lot about an international food crisis. Before the last few months, that was the big news. Food crises around the world, whether they related to wheat production, whether they related to biofuels, etc. And clearly, everyone's been affected by this by now. And we've seen all sorts of social movement activity around the world. We've seen food riots in Bangladesh and Egypt, Haiti over the cost of food. We saw the collapse of the Doha round of trade talks, and largely precipitated by the uneven meanings of free trade around the world as countries who had something to gain by having a free trade system demanded that the U.S. and Europe reduce their subsidies to agriculture. Social movement led. We've seen a huge interest in agrarian reform and food sovereignty movements. The Via Campesina is growing, MST in Brazil. These are huge. There's a major land reform movement in Indonesia. And of course, questions of food regulation are back on the agenda, as we've heard of the last bit of news, the reports of toxic melamine found in Chinese milk. So putting these together, we could would reasonably lead us to conclude that not only is food a major arena of protest, but that it is the neoliberalization of food and agriculture that activists are opposing. I'll talk about what I mean by neoliberalization in a minute. On the other hand, a surprising breadth of everyday food activism is strikingly apolitical, and really, as we started to discuss yesterday, about changing the world one meal at a time. This is from a quote from Alice Waters, a celebrity chef from Berkeley, who began the idea of California cuisine and also has really proliferated these ideas of edible schoolyards, throws a lot of money into different food projects to teach people how to eat, to teach people how to taste. Say here, change who we are. We need to first change how we eat. And this is the sort of stuff being championed by food writers, which is a growth industry itself. Not only is food crises a growth industry, so is food writing and just a couple of years ago. I think I counted maybe 10 books that have come out, all on the subject of how to eat, what to eat. Now, some of this stuff coming from the food writers really verges on the messianic, and I promised you yesterday I'd pick some more, pick on Michael Pollan some more, so I am today. So when I say messianic, I mean messianic. There's a picture of Michael Pollan. I didn't take this picture. I didn't compose this picture. It was in the San Francisco Chronicle. And there's this. Now, I don't know. I'm not high-tech enough to actually do this, but this was the cover of the food section in the San Francisco Chronicle about a year ago. Actually had a very bold headline, "What Would Michael Pollan Eat?" And there was pictures of him eating with his kids and how he cooks in the kitchen. So you see, at least in my part of the world, it's a growth industry to tell people what to eat, with Pollan being a messiah of sorts. And, you know, a lot of these books, it's all about the authors themselves. I think if those of you who've read Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma, which has some incredibly strong parts and some incredibly weak parts, have come home with a takeaway message that the best way we can eat is to go out and grow our own food and hunt our own food and shoot our own boars. That's become legendary, and in that way he shares something with Sarah Palin, who also seems to like hunting for her own food. That's not like a Pollan on the left, of course, but that's the only picture of a boar that's been hunted I could find, and I just couldn't resist the temptation to juxtapose these pictures. And I'm putting all the good jokes up front because the rest of this talk gets really dense. Okay, so in the case of this, Alice Waters, Michael Pollan phenomenon, as we discussed yesterday, this is a particularly rarefied, even coastal form of food politics that perhaps does not cut it in the heartland. But my point is this. In a lot of circles right now, changing how we eat, what we eat, has seemed to become an end in itself. And so rather than organizing around food as a way to galvanize people to address broader inequalities, more and more food activism is about changing how and what we eat. And now, that's emphatically, that is not to say that what we eat and how we eat is not somehow about inequality, that some people have access to higher quality food while others don't, is a question of inequality. But something important is being lost, and I'm going to return now to a quote I used yesterday of Michael Pollan's from his latest book, In Defense of Food. He says, "Not everyone can afford to eat high quality food in America, and that is shameful. However, those of us who can should." And then he goes on to say, "Doing so benefits not only your health by, among other things, reducing your exposure to pesticides and pharmaceuticals, but also the health of the people, also the health of the people who grow the food, as well as the people who live downstream and downwind of the farms where it is grown." So we're seeing here kind of trickle-down approach to environmental justice. If you eat right, then somehow it's going to benefit the people who live near farms, work on farms, etc. And of course, in not addressing the causes of food insecurity, food access and quality, he's I'm losing my train of thought today. He's losing attention to one of the key indicators of health, which is income. So most people have studied health inequalities know that having wages and income is the key to wealth. Is the key to livelihood. So he's not addressing these income inequalities at all. Okay, so my point is this, is that this whole focus on what to eat seems very far removed from the historical and structural conditions that created this very uneven geography of food availability and quality. And so my goal today is not to rant any more about Michael Pollan, I don't think so, but indeed to suggest that he has popularized and promulgated a particular approach to food activism that I find deeply troubling. And much of it I will argue, incorporates neoliberal characteristics. So let me begin the substance of my talk with this anomaly. How is it that current arenas of activism around food and agriculture seem to produce and reproduce neoliberal forms in the spaces of governance at the same time that it challenges the global landscape of neoliberalism? So what I hope to do in the rest of my talk is threefold. One is I'm going to do some definitional work, so we're all on the same page. Then I want to demonstrate the neoliberal character of some current food initiatives. And I'm going to focus on two that seem to be very different. So in their similarities and differences, I think we can learn some lessons. So I'm going to focus on farm-to-school programs, and I'm going to focus on fair trade labels, food labeling, voluntary food labeling. Seemingly very different approaches to changing food, but both of which I will claim are neoliberal in some aspects of their characteristics. And then I'm going to provide some tentative answers as to why food politics has become particularly susceptible to neoliberalization. Then, toward the end, we're going to think a little bit about the politics of the possible, which I think in part turns on what sort of political subjects are made in these food movements, and in part turns on questions of strategy. And I do have a little coda that I'm going to throw in there in light of the current crisis that I haven't really thought about yet, so you can help me think about it. It just was like one of those aha moments the other night reading the news. So let me do some of this definitional work. And in my definitional work, I'm taking from two very different approaches to thinking about neoliberalism. One is through a political economy perspective, which draws from traditional Marxian economics, and then I'm also using a governmentality perspective, which draws from more neo-Foucauldian work. And I hope to show why both are really important to understand what's going on. So this is a definition from David Harvey, a very famous geographer, who I just wish he were writing right this second to help us explain what's going on right now. So in here he says, as you say, neoliberalism is the first instance, a theory of political economic practices that basically that the human well-being is best advanced by liberating individual entrepreneurial freedoms and skills with an institutional framework characterized by strong private property rights, free markets, and free trade. The role of the state is to create and preserve an institutional framework appropriate to such practices. So this is, you know, this is the kind of policy we've been hearing about that Obama says we've had too much of and McCain wants more of, is letting the market do its thing. Now, it's interesting to talk about neoliberalism. When I planned this talk, I said, okay, I'll do that talk on neoliberalism. Now, you know, after watching what's going on the last 2 weeks, it's like, well, maybe neoliberalism really is dead. Now that we're nationalizing the banks and now that the rhetoric is completely changing, but I, you know, can't rewrite a talk that quickly. So this is going to be like, wow, that's dated. But it is interesting that a lot of the battles being fought politically right now are around, well, but this is what y'all wanted. You wanted to have the state only insure private property and insure the currency and insure free commerce, and this is what you got, and what are we going to do now? I want to also use this term of neoliberalization, which was popularized by a Wisconsin scholar, no longer, unfortunately, Jamie Peck and Adam Tickle. This is a very famous article they wrote, Neoliberalizing Space, in 2002. And they use the term neoliberalization to suggest a process, an ongoing process, rather than an end state, which makes a lot of sense because these things are always changing. And they also wanted to give room for all the counter tendencies and contingencies and all that sort of thing. But the reason I like using their work is because they kind of periodize this a little bit. And so they talk about this period of proto-neoliberalization where the theorists of neoliberalism were you know, developing their work, including Milton Friedman, who had this idea that the free market can do everything the best way. And no one took them seriously at the time, of course. And then the first major politicians to take them serious were, of course, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, who embarked on this major project of what Peck and Tickle call rollback neoliberalism, which means get rid of the state, remove the state where it's not needed, let markets do their thing. So deregulating, deregulating banking and food safety and worker safety and environmental, all that. That's the project they embarked on. privatizing as much as possible, cuts in services and entitlements, union busting, etc. So that was, you know, the kind of neoliberalism we saw in the 1980s, very mean-spirited. Well, then Peck and Tocqueville said, well, there's something that looks really different in the 1990s, really shepherded by Clinton and Tony Blair, which is what they call rollout neoliberalism, because the 1980s neoliberalism was so just kind of mean-spirited that it leaves, you know, then what kind of civil society do we have? So they said rollout neoliberalism actually involved more involvement of the state, but of a different kind. So on one hand, the state gets more and more involved with securitization and penalization, because once you've rolled back, you have all these people who are left impoverished or left with, you know, who may lead lives of crime. So what do you do with them? Well, you penalize them, you put them in prison. So the growth of prisons is, of course, a major expansion of the state. Or you fight wars to protect U.S. hegemony. And then the other thing that Peck and Tocqueville theorize in this rollout period is kind of the reemergence of civil society institutions that work to kind of fill in the gaps left by the state's withdrawal. So you have devolution, meaning delegating what were once kind of state projects to lower levels, to civic governments. You have more voluntary regulation. You have more kind of public-private partnerships, etc. And so these are what they call neo-communitarian ways of delivering services and regulation, much more voluntary, with this kind of mix of all sorts of, you know, business and nonprofit and faith-based and quasi-governmental organizations trying to do various things to address some of the inequalities created by rollback. So they wrote this article in 2002, really probably was in press at the time that Bush came around. I guess we could call the Bush regime rollover neoliberalization, where the Democratic Party just rolled over and did whatever he wanted, and then we're waiting for pushback neoliberalization. That's what the words that Peck and Tocqueville use. We honestly don't know what we're about to see, do we, right now? So it's hard to be predictive. So this is their framework that I think speaks a lot to some of the things I'm seeing in food politics. Okay, so this is a kind of neo-Foucauldian approach to neoliberalism. Now, some people might argue these aren't compatible approaches, and I don't really want to think about that right now. It's a different way to think about neoliberalism. And so this neo-Foucauldian approach is less concerned with what the nature of what states do or don't do to support capitalism, the public interest, whatever. But they focus on the techniques of rule, the political rationalities. So in a typical Foucauldian framework, you don't see the state as the cause of human action, but the result of human action. Okay, so, but here's where I think it's really important, because one of the problems with neo-Foucauldian analysis is you really don't know where all these ideas come from, but you can certainly see that these ideas persist. And so if you think of what Rose and others have talked about as neo-governmentality, they're talking about these sorts of rationalities of everyday being. So the idea that competition and accountability, consumer demand, should be the way in which we decide which is a better thing to have happen. So rather than governing through the state, neoliberal governmentality devolves responsibility to individual citizens who try to make choices and make choices to try to self-actualize. And so this idea of community emerges as a way of conceptualizing and administering moral relations among persons. So let me touch that down a little bit. So again, the focus on entrepreneurialism, that competitive logics, the market as a solution to the problem. So with kind of neoliberal governmentality, we as people are taught to understand that the market can best solve our problems, that we as consumers can solve through the market. Consumer choice is a sphere of regulation. this is really important here. And you can see this in the food writing, because even those who see a greater role of the state in food regulation, I'm going to give you an example, Marion Nestle. Has anybody read Marion Nestle's book? It's a huge critique of the failure of food regulatory practice, because industry has gotten their way and convinced the government not to ban particular chemicals, but just to label them, and then to say on the label, but we're not saying you shouldn't eat this, we're just saying this is, grapefruit is good for you, but, you know, white bread's not bad, or, you know, this kind of really loosey-goosey, not very strong regulation. But what's interesting about Marion Nestle, even though she has this very solid critique of the failures of food regulation, she still comes back to, but this is what you should eat. Learn how to read those food labels better so you can make those decisions. So again, the goal in a kind of in this sense is for people to make the right decisions, but it comes back to consumers. And then the other piece of it is this localism or neo-communitarianism. In this way, we're taught not to think about the broader society, but to think about our own communities. Our communities are the locus of caring. These are the people we should care about because we see them, we look at them in the eye, and that's some of its governmentality. And Rose makes this really important point about that. He says the political attraction of communitarian ideas lies in their apparent naturalness, their non-political or pre-political status. And we see this in political discourse all the time, right? We should care about our community. But Sarah Palin. I'm a Washington outsider. Washington's this big state thing that I don't get, but, you know, Joseph's back, and I didn't really think about how I was going to work with Sarah Palin, but here she comes again. You know, in our communities, we can make the best decisions. That's very much in this sort of neoliberal governmentality that Rose speaks about. And then down here, there's this issue of self-improvement and self-actualization. And this really came out of this critique of welfare, right? The critique of welfare came from both the left and the right, that people should be self-sufficient. But now, in an era where there's more and more inequality, there's so much effort to teach people to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, to grow their own food, to do what's right for them. But the idea of entitlement is that some people just are not, do not have access to adequate income, that's off the political agenda. It's all about teaching people how to self-improve, to be more entrepreneurial. We see that a lot in food projects. So all these themes that I'm talking about, I know that was really dense and way too theoretical, but I'm seeing a lot of those themes in current food activism. So let me really touch it down by giving you some examples. So here's my first case study, which is farm-to-school programs. What are farm-to-school programs? Basically, farm-to-school programs are a bunch of programs that are proliferating around the country where farmers team up with school districts or with nonprofit organizations to bring local, sometimes organic food directly to schools. And it's a great case study because, like, who can possibly be against that wonderful project of bringing farm-fresh food to kids who are eating really crappy USDA-approved food in school programs? So I pick on that purposely to kind of say, but what else is going on here? And farm-to-school programs demonstrate a bunch of different elements of neoliberalization that I've just discussed. And the other thing that makes them particularly interesting is they have to intersect with an already existing entitlement program, which is a school lunch program. So one of our earliest and most enduring entitlement program is a school lunch program or the school food program, where the USDA reimburses schools for feeding kids who are free or reduced income eligible. And the problem with the USDA's food programs is that they tend to encourage buying really low-cost food, and they require all these elements that may or may not be useful, and a lot of bad surplus food goes into goes into traditional school lunch programs. But nonetheless, it is an important entitlement program that's ensured many, many children for many, many years that they get at least one, if not two, good meals per day, which we can no longer take for granted if we ever could. So farm-to-school programs have to work with that. They don't like that, I might say. Okay, so that's what makes it interesting. So what makes it neoliberal? Well, anytime anybody says win-win, that already to me suggests neoliberal, because it's somehow that we're all in it together, and there are no winners and losers when we know there are. So that quote tells me what is my first tip-off there. But to make that more convincing, I think it's useful to compare farm-to-school with traditional school food programs. Can you read that? Okay. So there's a lot of ways in which there's interestingly similar. So when traditional school food programs were first developed in 1943, the idea was to provide a market for farmers, just like it is today. And the idea was to address the poor nutrition of school children. It was seen as a win-win solution then, too. Poor nutrition of school children at that point was defined as people who were perennially hungry with severe malnutrition. Today, farm-to-school programs are to provide a market for farmers, but a different set of farmers. It used to be the market for people who grow big money crops. Now it's for local farmers who tend to grow fruits and vegetables. And of course, the poor nutrition of school children comes into it too, but different kinds of nutritional problems now, from the obesity, type 2 diabetes, excess fat and sugar in the diet. But nonetheless, the motivating concerns are quite similar. But where it's different is where it's really interesting. So the financial support here was secure, it's federally funded. Foods were donated or subsidized. You know, a lot of the foods donated came from the commodity programs. So some of it, remember, surplus peanut butter. So it was really a way to prop up prices for farmers by getting rid of their surplus, and that ended up in school meal programs. But nonetheless, everybody. Okay, how about financial support for farming school? Very variable. Completely dependent on private funding. And usually food is not discounted or donated. Most of the farmers that I'm aware of participating in these programs, at least in California, I'll do my California caveats whenever the person who asks me, but it's different in Wisconsin, I'll say, I'm speaking from California. But nonetheless, the ones I've looked at, the farmers are not discounting their food. They want that market. They're looking for new markets. Even these organic vegetable producers are trying to secure markets and secure prices. And for the most part, in the study I did in California on this, the places where the farm-to-school programs were taking hold were wealthy communities. Santa Monica, Marin County, Ventura County, not in areas with the most need, was an important exception. There was this woman who was running, who had began the farm-to-school program in Compton, and she had begun in Santa Monica. The Santa Monica school food program, just Santa Monica is a very nice place. LA's beach city. Beautiful. And that one was promoted when Kenny G used his own personal chef to promote the program. So this woman who worked for the Santa Monica program said, okay, I'm going to go work on this in Compton, and had to really scrap it together. I mean, she had to do all sorts of things to make it work in Compton, including going and buying her own food from the farmers. So she got very little infrastructural support for it. And the other thing that was really interesting, because I've seen her speak at a bunch of conferences on the farm school program there, is because Compton, which is a largely, once was largely African-American, now it's more and more Latino, but fairly low-income community in Los Angeles County, most of the kids are on the school meals program, and then they have to meet all the the requirements for being on that program. So she showed pictures of her salad bar. And because they're on the free and reduced lunch program, they have to meet all the requirements of what the USDA requires. So the salad bar included cubed salami, cubed cheese, a bunch of surplus commodities, and then they had to employ somebody to watch to make sure people were taking meals that the USDA would approve as free and reduced lunch. So it's really crazy thing. Nevertheless, the point I really want to drive home is that these farm school programs are idiosyncratic. They're often funded by celebrity chefs or rich donors. They are not, for the most part, spreading to areas where there is the most need. Who does the work? Well, traditional school food programs are usually done by a food service staff who at one point were probably well paid. Less so once we started having kind of this tax rollback. And so starting in the 70s and 80s, we had more and more, fast food joints sponsoring school food. And the school food programs became more, kind of heat and serve, corporations like Cisco got involved. So at that point, there was less of a staff, but nonetheless, there used to be people who cooked. Now these farm school programs are run by volunteers. Non-government organizations, nonprofits are doing a lot of the work, so that's kind of an indirect subsidy to them. So that's very insecure. Those nonprofits don't get the money. Like in California, there's one nonprofit that's acting as a consortium for a bunch of different farm school programs where they're sending around their truck to pick up food from the farms and bringing it to school. That's not sustainable if their money runs out. So that's very insecure. And the other thing that we're seeing a lot is that the food staff is in really big conflict with the directors of these programs are in big conflict with the union staff. And we've seen this in the Berkeley School program, which is one of the most heralded, that the director of the food services program just can't stand the union employees and would really like to get rid of them. So we're seeing some conflicts around the type of labor in these farm school programs. And then the question is, who's benefiting? Well, this benefited obviously commodity farmers and children at nutritional risk. This is benefiting a class of farmers that in the whole scheme of things and farming these days is already doing relatively well, fruit and vegetable growers who have already left commodities. And of course, the children being benefited are largely in areas that are affluent, and many of these kids are already being exposed to the foods that they're being served at those schools. I mean, Berkeley's an interesting case in point again, because Berkeley's school district this is one of my daughter who's grown very familiar with it, but Berkeley has some fairly affluent people and some very low income, particularly African Americans, and there's all these conflicts that go on, even in the educational programs, because all the white kids from affluent families are saying, oh, we eat that at home, and you don't know you should eat that, and some of the African Americans are like, what's your problem? There's already conflicts around that kind of who's telling who how to eat, which is something I talked about yesterday. So there, in a place like Berkeley, some students are being reached who might not otherwise be, but that's because it's the contingency of Berkeley, which is an affluent community that likes to give to good causes. I'm sure that would be true here in Madison as well. Okay, so basically I'm saying there's similar goals, but they're highly uneven in effect because it depends on volunteerism and it depends on a lot of funding that is not coming from the federal government. And it's contributing to these neoliberal tendencies and labor relationships like unionization and dependence on volunteer labor. So that's some of the political economic reasons that I think that farm to school is neoliberalizing. And then there's also ways, and this goes to this question of governmentality, there's also a lot of neoliberal mentalities that are being produced in farm to school. So one of the major justifications for farm to school programs has been academic performance. So in a survey of 9,000 schools, 87% of principals said that the primary reason for having school gardens was academic achievement, and 73% said they'd seen improved academic performance from their garden as measured through test scores. So you see this kind of rhetoric being matched up with that same sort of rhetoric of No Child Left Behind, which is kind of frightening to me. Like, is this about nutrition, or is this about, oh, well, I mean, of course we want students to achieve, but the fact that it gets matched up with that achievement and test score rhetoric is frightening. There's a lot of penalization. I mean, I have a whole another critique about the obesity epidemic discourse that I can't really address today. But clearly, this idea that there's an obesity epidemic has become a major justification for these programs. In most of the literature I've read, within the first paragraph or two, we say obesity epidemic, therefore we need farm to school. I think it's really a problematic form of penalization. And what we're also seeing in schools that goes hand in hand with that are these weigh-ins, where many school districts are actually weighing kids to see if there's improvement in their weight. And so far that hasn't been coupled with farm to school, but watch this space. So I'm very concerned about this kind of focus on the child's body becoming wrapped up in farm to school. Another major justification for farm to school is the idea of producing consumers who will make the right choices. In a section on improving markets for family farmers, the National Farm to School Program brochure reads, "And by showing the children that fresh local produce is delicious, farm to school connections turn on the next generations of consumers to locally grown food." So it's about making consumers. And then there's this other question about localism, which is a much bigger conversation. But I think there's a way in which these farm to schools, which are already really based on this kind of communitarian ethic of, like, we should buy from our local area and we should eat within our local area. Really, this is a critique that Patricia Allen, who was here a couple weeks ago, speaks to. It really kind of helps narrow our sphere of caring. And there's ways in which the localism thing has become really silly. I just have to tell you one story because it's so silly. There's this growing locavores movement in Santa Cruz County. Santa Cruz County probably has the best weather for growing vegetables year and fruits year round than you can imagine. I mean, I think you can. There's probably there's hundreds of crops that can be grown in the summer, and there's probably a good 50 or 100 crops that can easily be grown year round in Santa Cruz County. But the locavores have this locavores challenge where in August, they say, "We challenge you to eat only food grown in Santa Cruz County in August." Not really a big challenge of the 200 or 300 crops that are available in Santa Cruz County in August. So that's problematic, and it's silly. But we can argue about localism, but in terms of what kind of ideas it's producing and showing, what worries me is it's creating this idea that only in our community are those that matter. And we really need to have our students very much care about the broader world around us, to recognize that what they get is somehow connected to what people aren't getting on the other side of the world. So this really concerns me about that. And what kind of locals don't get any attention at all? Really racing today, huh? Okay, now let me turn to something completely different, which is these fair trade and organic labels. And I'm probably going to run through this even quicker, so you'll have to excuse me. But I think it's useful to juxtapose these two projects. Okay, so what makes these interesting? Well, one of the things that makes voluntary food labels interesting is they're really one of the most... If we think about what are we going to do about the world food trade system, it's one of the most doable projects anybody can think of. And I often go around my classroom and ask, okay, what do you think should be done to address labor issues or something? They say, well, we should unionize, or we should address the border problem. I go, okay, what do you think is the most doable thing? They say, well, food label, a label saying this is a fairly... This product's based on fair work, fair wages. So labeling has become kind of the main way in which people are trying to address food issues on a larger system. What I'm talking about here is creating labels that certify that a particular product is grown or produced in a way that's more sustainable or more just or whatever. And I've written a lot on this because I've written a lot on organic labels. So what makes them neoliberal? And I'm really going to run through this, and you're just going to have to excuse me and ask questions at the end. One of them is governance. So rather than states saying what should or shouldn't go into a product, or what should be banned or not, these labels are governed by quite a patchwork of actors: states, international regulatory bodies, citizen-based NGOs, peasant cooperatives, private businesses, and they're operating at multiple and intersecting scales. There are no clear lines of authority. There's no insurance that many of these organizations have the capacity to ensure that their labels say what they do, and there's not all that much transparency. I mean, one of the whole justifications of labels is to know and see where your food's coming from, but many people don't. I mean, when people look at a can on, they say it's a fair trade or salmon safe, most consumers aren't really thinking about what that means or where it comes from, but even among those who are much more familiar with the labeling process, who decides what goes into that label? How is it monitored? There's really very little transparency there. And it's very uneven. All these different actors are doing it on a voluntary basis. So how do you know which one of the labels has some meat to it, so to speak, and which don't? Privatization. Most people don't think about these as labels as privatization, but I do. Because what does a label do if it's a certified label? Well, it establishes a property right. So really, as opposed to regulations that might force all producers to abide by a set of constraints, the constraints imposed by labeling schemes are voluntary. And they're made compensable, they're made worth it, by this some sort of price premium that consumers will get in the market. And so that means what they're doing is establishing a property right around the use of that label. To say something is organic, to use a the organic label is a property right to that label. If you put organic on that label, and if you don't comply by organic standards and haven't been certified by a regulatory body that says you do, you're violating a property right. We associate property rights intellectual property rights, like downloading Microsoft software illegally. But this is it's very similar. And it's a verification process, that certification process, that allows that label to be used and to gain access to market. Okay, similar, this idea of enclosure. I'm using these terms very pointedly because these have been associated with other forms of neoliberalization, like particular forms of land reform. No one thinks of applying these to voluntary food labels, but I think they work well. So how is food labeling an enclosure? What do you mean by enclosure? Enclosure means that some people have access to something and some people don't. Labels depend on barriers to entry. It's the only way to get money out of it. Because these are incentive-based regulations, if you abide by the practices, you get the premium in the market. There's great incentives to keep other people out. This is exactly what I saw in my research on organics, is once there was a certain group of people in the organic market, they wanted to increase their barriers to entry. They wanted to make it harder to be organic to keep their price premiums up. That's a form of enclosure. It's creating a form of scarcity. If everybody's organic, all of a sudden, and this happened because people found ways to skirt the barrier to entry, then there's no longer a premium associated with it, and then what? So it's a blah blah blah. One of the arguments I've made in my book is that this is really at odds to a broader way to encourage more sustainable practices. There are other ways to encourage that without creating these incentives that to gain a price premium and then keep others out. Valuation, really quickly on this. A lot of people were talking about the pricing ecosystem services, making commodities out of, you know, permits to pollute and all this. I think this also applies to labels, because we're putting monetary values on things that were heretofore not valuated. So while commodities are already traded in markets, the things associated with these labels, like fairness, ecological care, are not. So all of a sudden, you're in the position of saying, what is the value? How do you put the monetary value on being a nicer guy to your employees, or on using compost rather than synthetic nitrogen, et cetera? So the valuation problems are a little bit weird, but they are doing that. And then this question of devolution to the consumer. So for labels to compensate producers for doing the right thing, consumers have to believe the labeling claims and be willing to pay. So most of these labels are really depending on a redistribution between wealthy consumers and not so wealthy producers, I suppose. And so consumers have to be willing to pay. So consumers are ultimately making the decision about what sort of products deserve to be produced particular ways rather than others. It doesn't go through some other sort of means, scientific means or whatever, to test what would be the best practices. It's really devolving a lot of regulatory responsibility to consumers. And then the question of what sort of mentalities does this create? Well, it certainly increases the idea that the state really, you know, or proliferates the idea that the state really can't regulate, that state regulation is passe, that there's no way in which the government should ever intervene until the stock market crashes. So it creates the idea that there's no room for regulation at the state level. I think it also suggests that ethics and justice are things that should be valued and traded. I'm not sure we want to go there. And I think, again, it bounds the world we care about. And fair trade is particularly interesting because fair trade consumers are clearly thinking about producers elsewhere in the world, and that's what's good about fair trade. But who gets in that sphere? So we know there's a lot of fair trade coffee. So we know that consumers of fair trade coffee are caring a lot about coffee producers in Oaxaca or Sumatra or Guatemala. But how about rice producers in the Gambia? Will never have a fair trade label attached to them. So there's, you know, it's already, again, very limited about who's being reached by this. And so to the extent that coffee producers in Oaxaca are starting to get a good deal, and there's some research that suggests maybe not, all other sorts of food producing peasants around the world are kind of left out of the equation. The other thing that's really interesting in terms of recent research on fair trade, it seems to be much more about the buyers and the receivers of fair trade. I was at this conference on fair trade labels last year in Kentucky and saw some really new emerging research on this. And people were talking to peasants involved in fair trade networks, and a lot of these producers peasants were saying, I don't know what this is about. Those rich people seem to want it. I think it's another kind of charity or food aid, and we don't really see the results. I mean, there's a lot, the producers on the other side are not, A, they're not getting the returns, but they're not like feeling, oh, isn't this great that we have these transparent networks? You know, when you see on these fair trade things, we get to see the peasant producer in our coffee. It's unclear that the peasant producer in our coffee really wants to see us. So they're very not reciprocal. Okay. So it's unclear that everybody else is as enamored with transparency as fair trade consumers. Okay, boy, really speeding today. So I use these two examples because they're really quite different, but I think they're similar in important ways. As I've already suggested, they're uneven in who they have the possibility to reach. They're both concerned with making good consumer subjects, And in both, in different ways, they seem to be turning our heads away from structural concerns. So let me see if I can do a little bit of explanation about why these have gained such traction. Because really, we're really limited in the politics of the possible today, and we need to take that seriously. And so a lot of what's going on is because these are what's possible. So why is this possible in terms of political economy? Well, part of it is because we've had rollback neoliberalization, activists are increasingly in the position to redress these regulatory gaps and inequalities. And they often have to do the very best, and I've spent a lot of time putting out fires. So when you don't have a system that ensures some sort of public health, well, you have to you make it volunteer or whatever. So activists are having to put out fires because of these huge gaps of what a robust public sector could do. And likewise, or similarly, activists have to appeal to foundation funders these days more and more, and the foundation funders themselves are increasingly using techniques of neoliberal governments, like performance indicators and audits. And a lot of funders right now are showing you have to be effective and be on, show you can get your own money from this and be entrepreneurial within 3 years or you cut off funding. Or you have to show us results. So what do activists do? Well, they go for the low-hanging fruit. And they come up with programs that funders will like, which all really limits what they can do. And probably many of us have had experience with organizations in those situations. And so in some ways, activists are helping produce these neoliberal forms, not because they embrace a lot of the things I've been talking about, but in some sense because neoliberalism itself is characterized by these emergent forms of these kind of idiosyncratic alliances and networks to do the best people can to redress what's bad. And so we're getting this very much of a patchwork of activity and all sorts of public-private partnerships around that. So I think activists are pushed into that. But I want to suggest something stronger, and I want to argue briefly that food politics has actually helped create this. And this really goes back to my early work on organics, and I think that in many ways organic food regulation was the progenitor of this sort of regulatory politics. So, the organic movement, which really started getting its steam in the early 70s, was very frustrated, rightfully so, with the USDA, which just time and time again, as you all know, supported the worst of kind of industrial agriculture and would not consider more conservative or ecological practices. And so the organic movement went around the USDA, and some people in the organic movement, rightfully so, were very kind of anti-state, anti-regulatory, and so they decided to have their own kind of individual label. So they created the organic label, what some people call the mother of all eco-labels. And it was really designed to give consumers a way to opt out. I think at the time it made a lot of sense. Little do we know that this was going to become a prototype of so much of regulation, giving consumers a choice or information to opt out. So today we have all these popular representations of making choices, voting with your dollars, knowing where your food comes from, and linking knowledge explicitly with choice. The problem is, as I've been discussing, is that these projects only further have legitimated the devolution of regulatory responsibility to individual consumers. And that's, I guess, why I find Michael Pollan's work so problematic. Now, the good news is Michael Pollan was very active in the Farm Bill this year, to his credit, and I think that's great. But nonetheless, if you look at his best-selling books, it still comes back to what and how to eat. And I would say that In Defense of Food is actually reads as a diet book if you read it. Like it's very close to Why French Women Don't Get Fat. Because eat in small portions, put a little on your plate. It's kind of mind-blowing that that's where he's gone. But nonetheless, this is what worries me about this what-to-eat rhetoric. And I really think it started from this understandable giving up on the state as a site of regulation, and now has been like the only option. Like, we have to come up with our own voluntary schemes to do things better. But as I said, they're by definition limited because they create these barriers to entry. So what does this suggest about the politics of the possible? Okay, so this, what I've painted is a fairly bleak picture, I suppose. And I've really tried to think hard about what all this means for how we might get out of this mess. So let me kind of think about how we can think aloud about how we can think about doing more with what we have today. And first of all, I think it's really important to remember that even if we label something neoliberal, it's not unequivocally bad. And there's certainly a lot to be said about the infusion of ethical discourses into politics, especially if it creates more reflexivity and self-governance and so forth. And while I worry that the emphasis on what's doable, that low-hanging fruit problem, is missing the big picture, the problem is not so much that projects work at the margins. All activists need to start somewhere, and all, even global politics, are situated and take place in space. So it's not so much that they work at the margins. So I, having done this critique for an hour, I want to, you know, pull back on that a little bit and be kind of more sympathetic to things need to start somewhere. But given that, I think there's four things that we could, I think four, maybe five, things that we could be paying more attention to. And one is strategy, being strategic thinkers. I've been very critical, as you see, of labels as a form of food regulation. But some labels or threats of labels have pushed major food multinationals to alter their practices. So when people started talking about a no GMO label, all of a sudden Unilever started changing its practices of who they source from. I think that's changed back. But sometimes these are strategic. So the best example I can give you on the kind of difference in being strategic about or not is in California, there were a bunch of efforts in the last few years to create these counties that were GMO-free zones. And the first one that was successful was in Mendocino County. Anybody know enough about Mendocino County to know why that was successful there? You know what the biggest cash crop in Mendocino County is?
Grapes.
Marijuana. With grapes being a second. Okay. So Mendocino County doesn't want, you know, any kind of federal intervention in there at all. But and Mendocino County is kind of reclusive anyway. But activists took that as kind of a model and said, okay, let's go do these other GMO-free zones, and with very limited success. When it passed in Mendocino, and I think one other one was successful. I'm not remembering which one. The activists were like, oh, great, Mendocino is like a GMO-free zone. Well, who cares if GMO? Because we all know that genetically modified organisms travel. But some of the people behind this were very strategic, and they were thinking, well, no, well, of course it's ridiculous to think of a county being a GMO-free zone. What we're trying to do is to push on this politics of scale. We know that this is going to go to court. We know we can't have an uneven landscape of which counties are people who grow GMOs and GMO crops with GMO seeds, which ones they can. So let's use these kind of local initiatives to push it to higher levels and to make the courts kind of adjudicate this on a broader level. Well, we might say the courts aren't in our favor right now to adjudicate on the right side, but it was very much a strategic move. when we think about these labels, we have to think about them as further strategies, not ends in themselves. Who cares if Mendocino is a GMO-free zone? What kind of broader strategies does that precipitate is the question. The question is, what sort of political subjects are being produced? I mean, what are the people who participate in these efforts, what do they come out thinking about what they should be doing or thinking? And I think we get some different answers. I think some of these efforts really kind of produce this idea that we should acquiesce to consumer society, but maybe they don't. Maybe people who buy fair trade coffee start thinking more about, well, what does this food trade system look like, and what is the WTO doing, how did it come about, and what are the kind of broader ways in which we can rethink about how food is regulated? I don't know what kind of political subjects are making these efforts. This is a really important research question, though, that anybody who wants to take it up is welcome to, because that's important. If it stops at that, like, I've been a good consumer, then that's not good enough. But if it says, well, now that's making me think of something more, then these are very effective. So that's what we need to think about. We have to think very much about whose desires are being enacted in these projects, and that's why I brought up the example of these fair trade networks, where fair trade coffee consumers are so happy to see the picture of the peasant on the label, and the peasant's like, do I care about the picture of the consumer? Probably not. So we have to be really careful that and this was a subject of the talk yesterday, that the design, that what's motivating this is not our own feel-goodness, but it's really motivated by trying to make things better for so many people who've been left out of stuff. And so that means engaging very clearly politically with people who are really being screwed in today's world economy and seeing what they would do, which may not be a fair trade label. So we have to really pay attention to whose desires are being enacted. And how to work with the contradictions. There's a lot of contradictions in all this stuff, and there always will be. And so rather than say, oh, that's critical, now what am I going to do? I'm going to either ignore the criticism or I'm going to be actively consumed by the criticism. How can we think strategically with those and get away from this politics that everything has to be perfect or pure and say, okay, there's a contradiction here in fair trade. What can we then do about it? So that's just about thinking dialectically and thinking strategically. Okay, here's my coda. I barely thought this through. But, you know, I've been really kind of critical of these small idiosyncratic projects, the gardens, some stuff we talked about yesterday, these food delivery services, the community gardens that just don't seem to add up to much, they're idiosyncratic, because I don't think that strategically they're going to add up to more. But in light of the crisis we're seeing right now, I might prove myself really quite wrong. I had a conversation with somebody last week when we were learning about the financial crisis and what's really going to happen when so many people are laid off from their jobs and have very little in their pension funds or foreclosed on their homes. I mean, it's really quite frightening what's before us right now, and I think things are going to get worse before they get better. And it may well be that some of these very small potato projects will be sources of some sort of security, some sort of food security for many people. So I don't think that that's how they were thought of, but maybe indeed we are laying some sort of infrastructure for some unknown future that we don't know what it is, but it's coming soon. So that's just kind of thinking on my feet, and I would love to hear your thoughts on that, and I will just end with bringing together elite eating with the politics of today. So let me take your questions.
I think the Sue talks to Davis and Davis, of course, are very clear alert, especially scientists. And for instance, we might think that we are doing an alternative to the other producing actually for determination. And it can be not only food, but I think I write in the US, I see a lot of principles for health being a development structure in third world countries and everything, and what exactly happens. But my main inquiry is about your former slide about the politics of possible. And because what you were showing us is that we have to build an alternative to what is thought to be an alternative, which is very complex. We even can't usually make people understand the first one,
right.
Being Michael Pollan.
Right.
And we have to make them understand much more complex. And my question would be focusing on the means to do that. Because when you mentioned the Brazilian MST. And when MST is doing its political strategy, it generally embraces a variety of issues in one axis of alternatives, which is very political. Which is transforming the whole society and the system of relationships. And if you take that to the American social movements, how it's related or not. What is it? I can see a very big difference between the Tia Campesina and Brazil and the Tia Campesina in the United States, being more scattered, with more difficulty to bring up this, I would say, general alternative.
The second one's harder for me to speak. The second part of the question is harder for me to speak to, but let me start with the first and maybe I can work into it. We were actually having this conversation at dinner last night about what to do about Michael Pollan. Because people say to me all the time, first of all, people say your critique's right on, but they say to me all the time, but at least Michael Pollan's getting people to think about food in a different way, and that's really important. And what I'm doing in a talk like this and yesterday is like a critique of a critique of a critique. It's like, it's very hard, I apologize for that, for those of you who are like, well, I'm here and I've got, I've done this. I mean, these are talks that are really engaging with a bunch of contemporary debates about food politics. So Michael Pollan's a tough figure here, right? Because on one hand, he does do some great muckraking, and really, in a very accessible way, gets people to think differently about food. And if you go on Amazon.com, you can read commentary after commentary after commentary about how he's done that. But it's also really deeply problematic where he leaves off. And, in the Omnivore's Dilemma, he does this great critique of corn, of the corn system, and gets you thinking, God, I should, this is really bad. The subsidy system is really perverse. And then at the end of the book, you're like, I've got to go kill my own boar. And pick mushrooms, although I will never know where to pick them because his mushroom helpers won't tell you where the good spots are. he really leaves us at that place where it just comes back to how to eat. Now, Michael Pollan's in the business. He's a really smart guy, but he's in the business of selling books, too, right? He's not really in the business of creating a social movement, although he somehow has become anointed as the head of the sustainable ag movement. So it's a hard place to start in a talk like this when there's so many ways to bring people along. And if I did this talk for a broader audience, they're like, what is she saying and what is she thinking? And like, I thought I'm supposed to eat organic, and now you're telling me, So that's a hard place to be speaking from. But I think. I think what I'm trying to say is activists in the United States need to think more politically and need to think more strategically than we are. And it's so become about the politics of what to eat. Now, I know every movement has its contradiction. A very close friend of mine works on MST. And MST has had to completely change strategies now that it has a more supportive state. And MST was once against the Brazilian state, and now it has to work with the state. And it's created all sorts of other issues. Now, people have to stand in line to get property, to get title to their land, but it's still this bureaucratic thing. So I'm not saying like MST is like, oh, let's romanticize MST, but the thing is it does come from this more kind of political activist place. I don't see much of that happening in this country, and that's worrying me. And so that's kind of what I'm trying to spur. I don't know. That doesn't exactly answer the question. So I'm trying to think about it.
One comment and then a question. Speaking from generation of young people, I think part of the barrier to people getting involved in political activism is that people are so incredibly disenfranchised with the political system at all, that they feel far more empowered to make individual considered decisions than they do to do anything else. And so I would take a step back and talk about how can we create structures where people can actually do something political and be a political activist in society. That's a comment. The question I had that's kind of more specific and related to some things I've been thinking about is your comment about valuation of things that hadn't been done in monetary terms before. And it's something that I've just had kind of an icky feeling crawling on my skin about, and I haven't really been putting words, so I thank you for that. But a lot of people who talk about what the next step for sustainable agriculture is scaling up is how people see this working, making this, well, these small movements of CSAs and gardens and whatever more available to more people, more affordable,
right.
more.
Yeah.
In order to do that, you just run in logistically, it gets bigger, and you have to labelize or monetize the things that right now it's relationship marketing. And that always makes me feel icky, and I think why it is that you put words on it is you're valuing something that I wonder if you want to be valuing things like equity and justice in monetary terms and then putting a label on it saying this represents equity. So if that makes me feel icky, what do I do about that? Because that's what I see. If I want to help this movement grow, that's what I see me doing, bringing something. What are alternatives to that?
Well, it comes back to this question of where one might find change. It goes back to your first question, your first comment. I mean, it's a tricky thing. I guess I'm still kind of, when I listen to myself talk, I'm a statist. I mean, if we're really in this interesting moment, right? Because what are we going to, we're going to see something big right now. So what are the alternatives? I'm not going to say about continuing along the same path, which looks a lot like fascism to me. But what the other alternatives are some sort of kind of Green New Deal, right? Which is it's a new kind of Keynesianism, which may or may not work. But these are the sorts of things I think I've been wanting to see. Is, you know, kind of a state that has public interest, that redistributes, that regulates things in ways that serve a broader view. And maybe that leads to something that's called socialism or what. But there's this other kind of anarchist movement. I mean, these are really the kind of underlying ideas of what's going on in food politics. Some people are kind of more statist and some people are more kind of anarchist. And people don't talk about it in those terms, but that's really the underlying debate. And so a lot of these small gardening projects are more kind of that anarchist. That's why I put that coda in, is to say, well, maybe there's a point here that I need to think about. But what should we do? Well, what we're having this kind of valuation thing is the worst sort of thing, because it is the neoliberal model of paying for ethics, which is crazy. So we either need to say, okay. Either we need to have a state play a bigger role in this and think about ways to redistribute land or think about ways to increase entitlements or increase incomes, all these different possible, or regulate some pesticides out of existence or stop subsidizing the worst of commodity agriculture. I mean, the policy prescriptions are innumerable, but they're there. Or we say, okay, let's just let 1,000 flowers bloom, but somehow find the means to do it. But once we start making everything a commodity, we're playing into the same system, more so. Yeah.
your comment kind of like toward the movement toward the more federal regulation and stuff, and then at the same time you seem critiquing this kind of like Michael Pollan's telling people what to eat, but don't you think in the same way that the state would be telling people what to eat, do you think that would be problematic?
The state telling people what to eat. The state has been involved with telling people what to eat. It depends what kind of state. I mean, the state's always, the state's a problem. I mean, it's so hard to think about what the state is. There's no question that the critique of federal food programs is an important one. And the critiques of welfare programs are important because they were kind of, nanny, getting in people's noses that you get them, if you're getting this money, we're going to then tell you how to run your lives. And that's no good. So we need to envision other sorts of, maybe we don't even call it the state. We need to think of other sorts of public sector ways of regulation and redistribution. But I just don't see in a world of 6.4 billion how we can get to a better place without seriously taking something called broader government seriously. And we don't want it to be about telling people what to eat, but I don't think it's possible to do it from the grassroots up entirely. And it's certainly, even to get to a place that's more like that, look at the world we have right this second. Nothing's good going to happen without some major, major state intervention, hopefully in the right way. Or something, besides like handing out money to the Lehman Brothers. Exacts. this is the moment where we say, well, look, what's on the table here? Yeah.
It seems like you're critiquing though a lot of these movements, like the farm to school, that is saying that you have to eat vegetables instead of kind of different foods. That more they're creating regulations, through non-state institutions, basically. But that would be the same thing that the state would do.
I'm not sure I'm following because farmers. What's wrong about the USDA food programs is they come up with like what to get this money. Children have to get X servings of dairy and X servings of meat and X servings of vegetables and a lot of it's coming from crummy commodities. But it doesn't have to be that way. It's possible you could have federally funded food programs where you just. So we get to choose among a variety of something that somebody decides is healthy food. You always have the question of some group of people being delegated with the task of deciding what's healthy. I don't know how you get around that. It can be state actors. It can be a committee of parents. It can be, but not, not everybody can be in the room at the same time. So we're always going to be faced with this question of somebody's got to decide for other people. Hopefully you come up with the best mix of people. We don't know what real democracy looks like to even imagine what that looks, to imagine how that would be. So you say, okay, we're going to call this a healthy meal, and we're not going to force people to eat particular servings, but somebody's got to decide what their healthy meal looks like.
I was just going to say that the conversation is about nutrition. We can talk about how to democratize nutrition and at the same time create a more responsible state that is involved in the purposes of nutrition. But that's only one tiny sliver of the conversation here, I think, in my mind. If what makes us feel icky about neoliberalized solutions or neoliberalized forms of social change is because it's not just about nutrition, it's about social justice and everything that's happening. So we think about what kinds of stuff the state can do. It has to do with school lunch programs, but it also has to do with labor laws, and it has to do with human rights protections and so many different kinds of things. So I think sometimes we get sidetracked just looking at food when what we're really interested in is a broader set of social goods and public rights.
I just have a question about your quota, and that's if this these community gardens and stuff do end up being the infrastructure on which we build something. Do you see things going more towards anarchism, or is this like a reconceptualization of the state where you have something coming from the grassroots and then the state sort of meets it halfway?
Let me find that crystal ball.
Some kind of postmodern activism. And what does that mean then?
I don't know what it means. I was just talking to a student this morning who was interested in policy and urban agriculture, and I said, well, wouldn't it be interesting to find out in any various city, what's driving these? Are these urban agriculture projects, are they being driven by squatters? Are they being driven by policymakers who are interested in gentrification, or who are interested in food security, or who are interested in beautification? I mean, there's many, many motives behind urban gardens, and we don't often know what's driving it. So those are empirical questions that we don't know yet. It's always hard to predict, but and you know, I use the anarchist, socialist, or status typology just to kind of clarify that these are different approaches. But I think in any real world politics, it would always be some combination. And I think community gardens is actually a useful way to think about it, because a lot of the community gardening movement in the 1970s was very much about this kind of grassroots. We're taking over this vacant lot, and you can like it or not, and it's a community garden. And now a lot of cities are saying, oh yeah, community garden, that's great, for bunches of different reasons. Sometimes gentrification, sometimes food security, sometimes drug rehab. I mean, for a bunch of different reasons. So in that way, you know, the local policymakers may be following what the activists already did. These are always, there's no kind of rule about that, and I don't think there will be in the future. A more progressive state, which we have to hope for, maybe would encourage that. And there's some elements of that in the farm bill too. So in that way, I mean, the people, the grassroots people, kind of modeled something. But I don't know the big answer to that question. Watch this space. I mean, we shall see. There's a lot of unknowns right now. It's really a big time. Jill's comment really brings back what I think is the kind of take-home point of both of the talks I've given. Is what I'm trying to say is really that food is it's a wonderful thing to mobilize around, and God knows I like to eat food. And food's great and all that, but food it's not to become an end in itself. I mean, if we're food activism, I'm afraid it's taking this unfortunate turn of becoming about food and about the meal, and not about a way to address broader inequalities. There's a great line somebody has, I have to see if I can bring it in my head. But that Alice Waters quote is like, it's not about changing the world one meal at a time. It's like using the meal to change the world. I mean, it's become an inversion of what I think we could do with that. And we have to address broader inequality. And if food and agriculture is a way to do that, all the better. It's not just about changing what we eat. I think I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.